Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we are here with the real Muhammad Ali, that is Dr. Muhammad Ali Rafai, a psychiatrist who was recently acquitted from a DOJ charge of Medicare fraud. And with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Rafai and have him tell a little bit about his background.
Thank you very much for having me today talk to your audience. It's a pleasure to come back and talk to you again. Just a refresher, in November of 2022, the United States Department of Justice and the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania presented an indictment to the grand jury for four charges of healthcare fraud against me and against my practice, Blue Mountain Psychiatry. We decided at that time to go to trial. The trial was held in May 2024, and the trial lasted for about 7 days. We presented our case to the jury. I had two expert witnesses. I did not testify at trial, and the jury returned in 3 hours with a verdict of not guilty on all charges. So. Wow. Fast forward to today. It's almost a year after the not guilty verdict. And with all the political developments that's happening, changes in the Department of Justice, I'm currently in process, and I put out a press release that I have filed a litigation against the United States Department of Justice for damages, including attorney's fees and litigation expenses, as well as for sanctions on the prosecutors that conducted this prosecution. And it is in front of the judge, currently waiting for the government to answer for the conduct of the United States Attorney's Office, Eastern District of Pennsylvania, in this prosecution. There is some developments. The United States attorney that prosecuted me was fired by President Trump. And the two prosecutors that were involved in the case, in my case, actually retired within a few weeks of me filing this motion for attorney's fees and sanctions utilizing a federal law that's called the Hyde Amendment.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Hyde Amendment once we get a more clear picture of how things have played out, because I want to emphasize just the ridiculousness of this entire ordeal and the overall impact that it has before we get into some of the more litigious aspects. You were indicted in 2022. The trial took place in 2024. By DOJ standards, that is light speed. But the impact was still quite severe on your professional and your personal life. Can you talk a little bit about just the impact from your medical practice to dealing with the state board, how all of that kind of converged while this was going on with the DOJ?
Sure. So the investigation actually started in 2017. This is how far it goes. And it stemmed, which was disclosed at trial, it stemmed from actually two disgruntled employees that indicated that our billing was not accurate. And so basically they initiated litigation, which the Department of Justice decided to carry and intervene on their behalf with actually a criminal prosecution rather than a civil prosecution. So kind of they upped the ante. I decided to go to trial because I was confident of my innocence. It took a while for me to be able to convince my attorney that I was not guilty of the charges that they were charging me. The experts actually played a very good role in convincing the attorney that there was no guilt on my behalf, that I was completely innocent, and the jury saw that and exonerated me completely. Usually these days, a not guilty verdict really means innocent. because basically the presumption of guilt is always there whenever somebody is indicted.
Especially for physicians, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody would ask, "What this person must have done something wrong."
Yeah.
Even after a not guilty verdict, people still say, "Well, he must have done something wrong that aroused the suspicion of the government. It's only a fluke. It's by chance that he was found not guilty." Yeah. And they don't know that it's actually basically that there was no evidence. There was no evidence supporting any guilt. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because now you are challenging the way the prosecution took place. And that requires a certain higher standard, because for the layperson, they may think, oh, well, prosecutors prosecute. So sometimes they win cases, sometimes they lose cases. But in the medical arena, it's a little bit different, because a law is never just a law. There's always something fundamentally subjective that gives the prosecutor room to manipulate the truth in certain capacities. So talk a little bit about what you're trying to do with the Hyde Act and how that's going to impact the litigation going forward against the prosecutors.
So the Hyde Amendment is a law that was passed actually by Congress in 1997. And basically, it was passed because Congress was upset at the United States Department of Justice, because they had at that time actually prosecuted multiple members of the Congress. One of them actually was a Pennsylvania congressman. And basically, Senator Henry Hyde basically did this Hyde Amendment. And basically, he was convinced to kind of lighten up the requirement, because he basically said, well, you know, anybody who gets indicted and is found not guilty has recourse to go after the government for attorney's fees and sanctions toward the prosecutors. They decided to actually switch that a little bit and basically indicate that the case has to be frivolous, vexatious, and in bad faith. Those kind of are the requirement. And you have to prevail. You have to be a prevailing party. You have to be somebody who's found not guilty, basically.
Yeah.
Kind of meeting those standards is very uphill, because the prosecutors can always kind of say, well, there was a case against him. It was just his luck. The jury liked him, or it was a fluke,
yeah,
or something like that. However, we are able to demonstrate that this wasn't the case. There was a complete disregard for the evidence. They didn't look at the evidence. Basically, the case was frivolous, because basically many of the facts that were presented by the prosecutors were not supported by the evidence. They basically, for example, the frivolousness, for example, they used the CPT coding, the American Medical Association current procedural terminology. They used the CPT coding from 2012, but the services that we provided were in 2017, and the psychiatry CPT coding changed in 2013. So the 2012 were not valid for the services that I was providing, but they were actually going by the old CPT coding. So that's part of the frivolousness. I mean, so if you don't know what the code is, or what's the standard, or what's the law, you can't claim that your case is valid. This is totally frivolous.
So let's talk about that, because most of the public fails to understand just how nonsensical a lot of the evidence that is presented. In your experience, can you give two or three examples specific to your case in which clinical information or clinical data, in your case, the CPT codes, were then concocted into evidence, and how that manipulation took place? Because I think it's very important for people to understand how that process takes place, whereby evidence is concocted by misappropriating clinical data, clinical evidence.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, a lot of people who are not familiar with the litigation and law and federal law don't know that actually when somebody is indicted, when the federal government decides to file charges against you, it's usually the individuals who make the decision on those charging decisions. It's usually the federal agents from the investigative agency. So it could be the Federal Bureau of Investigation, could be the Office of Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services, or it could be the Drug Enforcement Agency. They get together with a prosecutor and make the decision on whether this is a criminal matter, and they're going to seek charges. So your fate is actually in the hands of a very limited number of people. They're the one who decides. They're the judge. They're the jury. They're the executioner. Our prisoner of war friend, Captain Joseph Parker, said, next to execution, a criminal indictment is the most painful thing that could happen to anybody.
Yeah.
And to think of that, it is the U.S. attorney who's the supervisor for the prosecutor, the assistant United States attorney, and the federal agents. They are the one that make the decision on an indictment. And usually when they decide to indict somebody, probably between 95 to 98% of individuals decide to plea bargain, basically admit to the crime that they're being charged. And they agree that this charge is correct, and they will actually decide to sign a plea agreement and admit to guilt and submit to punishment. So I think that, basically it's automatically, basically, when these people decide that they are indicting somebody, that's it. That person is on their way to jail.
Yeah.
Unless they decide that they want to fight the case and go to trial. Only about 2% of people go to trial. And out of those that go to trial, probably less than half of that are found not guilty. The other half are found guilty at trial, and there is a trial penalty, basically, that is enshrined into the sentencing guidelines, basically, where somebody is given an additional point because, basically, they wasted the government's time and money and took them to court, and they did not admit to guilt. They also lose a point because they're basically did not admit to guilt.
Yeah, so this point concept I think is important to go over, because what people don't understand is that when you have these sentencing guidelines, it's basically set on an arbitrary metrics of points, where if you demonstrate guilt, so if you plea, you lose 1 point, and as a result, you get a lower sentencing. If you go to trial, you gain a point. If you have prior convictions or prior criminal history, you gain certain points. So it really is that arbitrary, where they're looking at sentencing guidelines based on a point system that is many times devoid of the case itself, but simply used as a metric to quote-unquote standardize the sentencing, but really in a way create a fear in the mind of the defendant.
Absolutely, absolutely. A lawyer once told me, there's two kinds of people that decide to go to trial. They're either crazy or they're not guilty. He's a federal criminal defense attorney. So you're either crazy because you understand the odds and you still decide to go to trial, or you really believe in your innocence and you're ready to bear all the consequences of going to trial. And trial is always something that is unpredictable. You don't know what jury you're going to get. I mean, it could be a non-friendly jury, or it could be a friendly jury, and there could be always unfair things. So getting back to your question about how do the prosecutor kind of channel the evidence that's against a criminal defendant, a physician criminal defendant, in a way that convinces the jury to basically convict physicians, and that's what they do. Is they look at any error that happens, and in medical practices, there's a lot of errors that happens, billing. So, for example, one of my staff actually entered a billing service on the wrong patient. That was a deceased patient. Instead of a patient who has a similar name but a different date of birth. And basically, that was one of the things that they paraded in the indictment. They said, oh, he billed on dead patients. Now, it was one or two patients that were entered by error that we never got paid for. That was an error from the staff who actually on the stand admitted that it was her error. And basically, they brought that up as evidence of fraud. So there's a lot of opportunities for the prosecutors to bring any errors that happen in a regular medical office as a demonstration of fraud, and basically to say that, okay, the this doctor's practice is all fraudulent, and so that's why we indicted them.
Let's touch on that a little bit more, because I think it's becoming more pervasive. Whereas before, let's say 10, 15 years ago, there would be these aberrant cases of billing fraud or the opioid-related cases. But now we're starting to see this with abortion. We're starting to see this with other types of medications, whether that's ADHD medications, anxiety medications like benzodiazepines. There is this idea where you will take a clinical error and then ascribe intent to that error, thereby presenting it as a criminal act when it was very much a clinical act. And as the Institute of Medicine had deemed back in the early 2000s, to err is medicine. There are errors.
Error is human.
Talk a little bit about these patterns you're seeing, not just in your case, but in other cases where you start to see this notion of ascribing intent to clinical actions that are very much within the purview of practicing clinical medicine.
Sure. So one of the things that I think saved me in my case, specifically talking about intent, was that we showed an email. I did not testify in my case, but there was an email that I had sent to my entire staff a month before these charges that they decided that I committed healthcare fraud, where I specifically said, you know, we want to be compliant with all Medicare rules and regulations. I wrote that like verbatim. I want to ensure that we are compliant with all Medicare rules and regulations. We need to do this and this and this, and we need to watch our time. We need to ensure that we are billing correctly. If there's errors, we rectify them. So that basically one of the main things is that you showed your right intent. I wrote my intent, which was to comply with all Medicare rules and regulations. If there was unintentional errors, they're unintentional. But the prosecutor could always manipulate the data. A very, very famous case is actually the case of Dr. Richard Paulus, who's an interventional cardiologist. He's from Kentucky. And he was, poor Dr. Paulus, he was prosecuted for about 12 years. They indicted him in 2014. The investigation started in 2012. He went to trial twice. He's an interventional cardiologist, and they said, well, you know, this Dr. Paulus inserted stents on cases that did not need stents.
Yeah.
So basically, the typical kind of fraud, healthcare fraud. And, you know, heart catheterizations are very expensive. They wanted a lot of money from him. And they presented in his first trial, they presented evidence of 70 heart catheterization, where they showed that the narrowing of the coronary arteries wasn't significant, and that these people didn't need stents, or there was a disagreement between the expert cardiologist that the government brought and the expert cardiologist that the defense brought, and that this narrowing wasn't enough. So 70 stents, he was actually convicted.
Yeah.
Except that later on, after his trial, after a month of his trial, the government disclosed to the defense that actually it wasn't 70 catheterization. They had 1,100 catheterization, and only those 70 was there a disagreement between the government's witness and the defense witness. So it wasn't 70. The universe of the cases wasn't 70. It was 1,100, and so his rate of error was 6%.
Yeah.
And so,
I just did the math, 6.4%. Yeah.
he actually went to jail. He spent about 9 months in jail until the appeals court, the circuit court appeal, vacated his sentence.
Yeah.
And basically, the government decided to try him again. They brought the same facts. They tried him again. And actually, the second trial, it was a hung jury on his second trial. And, you know, imagine this Dr. Paulus, he had enough financial resources to take on the government for that long and two trials. And ultimately, in 2024, basically, the government says, oh, we've decided to drop all charges. You know, and Dr. Paul is in his 70s, and he had decided that he's not going to practice medicine anymore. And but he had two trials, went to jail for close to a year, and they dropped all charges. Yeah. And the evidence, this is how they manipulated the evidence. Clearly, that, and this word is actually the appeals court. They said the government manipulated the evidence because they showed that it's like whole 70 cases that he was wrong on the 70 cases, but it was a larger universe. It was 1,100 cases. And it's so 6% was an acceptable error of disagreement between experts. It was like, is this coronary artery narrowed enough to merit a stent or not? 6%. And this was he was prosecuted on. So,
yeah. And zooming out on that, it's important to recognize that the evidence the government presented was the opinion of another physician who was on the government payroll. So he was a paid expert witness who simply disagreed with Dr. Paulus's clinical assessment.
Sure, sure, yeah. And it was I don't think that I would ascribe that the it wasn't people that routinely testified for the government. They brought the chair of cardiology in a clinical department and said, here are 70 catheterizations. Tell us, do they need stents or do they not need stents? But they only showed him the 70. They didn't tell him that they were 1,100. So they actually hoodwinked their own expert witnesses and told them. And the appeals court said that the government hoodwinked their own witnesses and told them it was only 70 cases. And so the experts testified to say, well, listen, 70 cases. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. All of these cases are iffy in terms of needing a stent. So this is what they testified for.
Yeah.
So the government could hoodwink their own expert witness, tell them whatever they want. We know there's actually an ongoing trial of a colleague, and they have his expert, and basically they gave him only 2 minutes of a clinical encounter, and then when it was played in court, the clinical encounter was 1 hour, and they showed the expert only 2 minutes. And the expert says, what is this evaluation? It's only 2 minutes. They didn't do anything. They just gave him medications, and the person was at the door. But yeah, the actual encounter was 1 hour. And so when the defense played the case, tape in court, it was a whole different atmosphere. And needless to say, this expert is going to come back and is going to have to answer to his 2 minutes versus the 1 hour tape.
Yeah, it's just amazing how arbitrary the evidence can be that the government compiles. And I think it really should be more widely known in the medical community that the government is using these tactics. And I think as now more conditions are being criminalized, more people in the medical community will start to realize just what the government is actually doing and how politically ambitious, you can say, many of these prosecutors are. Talk a little bit about now your own legal advocacy following your acquittal and what you hope to get out of your case as serving as an example of how a physician can bounce back, not only from being inappropriately charged, but also get legal recourse in certain ways.
Sure. So one of the main things, part of my prosecution is related to the fact that I care for Medicare recipients, people on disability or retirees in rural Pennsylvania that are on Medicare. And basically I decided that I wanted to service this population. As a psychiatrist, I could have only taken insurance or I could only taken cash. That wouldn't have been an issue for me. But I decided that it was my responsibility as somebody who was trained was actually at the National Institute of Mental Health. I was with the Public Health Service, that it is my duty to treat these patients. And it's very interesting that also that there's a dichotomy or a divorce between the United States Department of Justice and the United States Department of Health and Human Services and the Center for Medicare Services. Because Medicare said, well, you know, we don't see that you're doing anything wrong, but the Department of Justice indicted you. So we're not gonna eject you from the Medicare program. We're just going to place you on payment suspension. But we want you to continue to see those patients that you have. until your situation is resolved, Dr. Rafai. And I, with the Lord's blessing, I was able to maintain. I continued to see patients until the day of the trial. And after my acquittal, I started seeing patients again. When I was acquitted, I actually sent the acquittal to my a congressional representative and to my senator. And basically, they advocated with the Center for Medicare Services. They turned on our billing privileges within 30 days. This was how quick they turned it on. So I'm lucky that the Center for Medicare Services was responsive to this. I'm in good standing with them. Basically, they turned on the billing privileges very, very quickly because they realized that there was a not guilty verdict. But that kind of gave me a lot of will to push through. I want to continue to see these patients. So I have these 400 Medicare patients that there's nobody out there to see. I'm in rural Pennsylvania. If I say I'm going to close my practice tomorrow, I could find a job at a local hospital, or I could move out of the area, or I could go internationally and have another job. But this is what I was trained for. This is the public health service. I'm board certified in internal medicine and psychiatry. I need to service my community. But this is the, and so there was no regard from the United States Department of Justice to that. And this was brought up in trial that I was providing services to an indigent population, and that there was a lot of confirmation bias from the prosecutors. The four charges that I got charged with, each charge was $43.46, less than $180. And they wanted to put me in jail up to 40 years, and they extrapolated to $1.5 million on the services with like bogus math, bogus extrapolation. So there was it was all nonsense in terms of like when you do paper and pencil, it was all nonsense.
Talk a little bit about how the government is able to pull out these extractions, because I see a 1.7 or something along those orders of restitution for four bills that didn't even total $200. So talk a little bit about how they create these extrapolations where they say, well, we have four charges and you did over X number of years with Y volume. Talk a little bit about how they calculate the math, because I think it's important for people to understand just how bogus a lot of these numbers really are.
Sure. So I think the bogusness in this case is the fact that they did not follow their own procedures. So there is something called the Medicare Integrity Manual, and it has a specific chapter. My expert in this case, Sean Weiss, the compliance guy, basically talks about the Chapter 8 of the Medicare Integrity Manual, where they actually have to do an extrapolation. They have to do a legitimate statistical extrapolation. They have to enter the numbers into a statistical model and tell you how is it that they did the extrapolation. And you know, I'm a researcher. I was at NIH. They're not going to get that over me. We showed that they never did any extrapolation. They never did any statistical modeling. They have to do something called a Monte Carlo simulation to tell you exactly how is it that they calculated. How is it that they get from $200 to $1.3 to $1.5 million? And they never did any of that. They just guesstimated. And the reason why they guesstimated that is if the loss is more than $1.1 million, you get additional points on sentencing. This is the only reason. And they do not like to prosecute people for anything less than $1 million. So those are the two main reasons why I ended up being prosecuted, and they chose the number of $1.3 million. It's just they pulled it out of thin air.
I think that's
I don't want to use any vulgar language. They pulled it out from somewhere else. But basically, that's the whole gist of it.
No, you know, and Dr. Rafai, it's a testament to your character that you're able to kind of look at this with a smile on your face. But I think it's really important for people to understand that there was a certain maliciousness on the part of the prosecutor to get to that 1 million threshold. So essentially, by exceeding the 1 million threshold, they're then able to impose the threat of a greater punishment on you.
Yes.
So it's important to understand that when people talk about sentencing guidelines and they talk about how they want to standardize and make more fair the sentencing, effectively in implementation, It's used as a tool to punish. And the way they calculated your number was to maximize the threat of punishment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of it is that the analysis, the reason, one of the main reasons that we're arguing that the case was frivolous is that there was no analysis. It was, mm-hmm. it was that they made up the numbers. I mean, frivolousness is basically saying something that has no basis in fact. This is, yeah. I mean, so there's no basis in fact. If in order for you to say, well, the loss is $1.3 million, you have to have had an analysis. How did you reach that number? You can't just pull it out of thin air. Did you do a statistical? They have had to hire a statistician, a PhD statistician, and they have had to show a report where they did statistical modeling and tell you, well, okay, so we're thinking that all of these cases are fraudulent. Well, they can't be 100% fraudulent. Even a broken clock is correct twice a day. Mm-hmm. So it can't be 100% all wrong. 93. And then, well, how did you do the analysis? What was your universe? Did you, and we, the expert that testified for the government on the stand, she said, oh, she only reviewed two charts. It's like, well, how is it that you out of two charts, you find out that you're able to extrapolate to $1.3 million just based on two charts? In the Dr. Bothra case, prosecution in Detroit, they had only six charts, and they wanted $453 million from Dr. Bothra. That's the analysis. I mean, yeah. So out of six charts, they extrapolated to $453 million. Sean Weiss testified in that case, and he put the kibosh on that very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting. What's so damaging about that, really what's so dangerous about that, is the media just takes it. The media just accepts it hook, line, and sinker and says $450 million. Dr. Rafai, $1.7 million. So they create these grandiose schemes where you start to feel the effect of propaganda. Can you talk a little bit about how government deception in manipulating the evidence then turned into effectively a propaganda campaign?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to tell you what's going on with, in my case, and actually an additional kind of factor to my case. So basically, I said, you know, I want sanctions on the attorney. I want attorney fees, and I submitted the motion to the judge with the judge's approval. The judge said, oh, you should send a motion if that's something that you want to do. You should send a motion. I will consider it, and I will ask for a reply from the government. So the government, I mean, so the U.S. attorney was quite upset. I submitted the motion about a week or 10 days before she was fired by President Trump. And on her way out, she was really, really upset. And she made a reference in the press release that she put out touting her achievements during her 2.5 years as a U.S. attorney. She made reference to dirty doctors who poisoned the community brought to justice. And I was the first doctor that she prosecuted. So she referred to me as dirty doctor, poisoned the community, and brought to justice. Well, all my case was a healthcare fraud. Well, how did I poison the community? Yeah. And I was brought to justice, and the jury found me not guilty. Yeah. And so I actually sent a supplementary motion to the judge. And I said, Judge, look what this U.S. attorney on her way out, this is what she's writing about me. I'm the only doctor that she prosecuted that time, and she's referring to me as dirty doctor. So that actually plays into the bad faith, and I called it bad faith, and it's public statements. So mm-hmm. they're intentionally doing bad faith, incorrect public statements to basically, now it's besmirching the reputation of all doctors, because she said dirty doctors. She didn't refer just Dr. Rafai, a dirty doctor. So this is something I put the motion, and I said on behalf of my local medical society, the Pennsylvania Medical Society and the American Medical Association, she is basically besmirching a whole population of professionals unfairly with no evidence that she's, what does poisoning doctors, poisoning the community means? Yeah. Is it people who are prescribing puberty blockers to kids? Is it people who are giving COVID vaccines? Who is it that you're meaning? Who do you mean? So she meant a whole population of physicians that now she's besmirching, and judges don't agree with that. Don't agree with such bellicose statements made by prosecutors.
And that's really fascinating. In the remaining time that we have, can you provide any words of advice or guidance for physicians or really anybody in the healthcare setting who may be encountering something similar and is just looking for a point of inspiration or somebody to just serve as a beacon of light in what may be a very dark period with the federal government just manipulating facts and targeting them in such a malicious manner?
Sure, sure. So I mean, I see a lot of there's an appetite to just blame somebody, and the federal government. You know, physicians, we're in our offices. Basically, we're easy target. They know where to find us. They target older physicians. They target more mature physicians who have assets to be forfeited. There's money for them to take away, people who are easily, threatened and manipulated. And basically they stack the charges. It is very important that if somebody is facing legal problems, is to seek, immediate guidance from a specialized attorney. I mean, this is what I call is the neurosurgery of criminal defense law. So basically, unless you have somebody with healthcare experience, you shouldn't go with them. You shouldn't just get your neighbor attorney who has no experience with federal criminal defense to defend you in something like that. You need somebody who specializes. And we know our friend Mr. Ron Chapman is wonderful in doing that. But there's a lot of other wonderful attorneys around the country that specialize in healthcare. In my case, I hired an attorney, a very, very competent criminal defense attorney who had lots of trials under his belt. And one of my advantages was that his family were psychiatrists. His dad was a prominent psychiatrist in Philadelphia. His brother is a prominent psychiatrist in Philadelphia. So he knew the field of psychiatry. And he knew exactly what to present, what to talk about, and was very instrumental in being able to present to the jury evidence of that I was not guilty. We also utilize expert witnesses. We had Mr. David Klein and Sean Weiss, and we actually hired a community psychiatrist who testified on my behalf. So these cases need specialized care. They need the neurosurgeon, healthcare fraud criminal defense attorney that specializes in that. That's what needs these cases. You need plenty of experts. You need lots of experts to counter either the experts that are presented by the government. In my case, the government basically didn't present a lot of experts, and so we were able to counter those very, very quickly. And then you need a unique investigative team that's able to bring in witnesses to testify for your care and on your behalf. So, for example, in my case, Mr. Chapman's investigative team was able to bring to bear lots of my patients. In my case, for example, one of my patients who actually is a nurse who I treated, and she's on Medicare, and she actually came to the courtroom to testify on my behalf, and she started crying on the stand. And she said, "This Dr. Rafai saved my life." And she looked at the jury and she started wailing and crying. And she said, "He saved my life. Release him, release him, release him." And this is on the stand. This is a nurse. So kind of being able to bring in witnesses like that, that are compassionate about the care that's being provided by the physician is very, very important also. As well as being able to bring in expert witnesses. So, for example, in the article, I talk about the case of Dr. Kusa. Dr. Kusa is another a primary care doctor from Kentucky that was actually defended by Ron Chapman. He was basically, his case is even more ridiculous than me because he was prosecuted for healthcare fraud as well as controlled substances. for prescribing a controlled substance to somebody who's disabled, who had a chronic injury, and even after appropriate workup. But they tagged on healthcare fraud, and they said, well, he did too many EKGs on this person. Each EKG was $6. And the total healthcare fraud was $60. They said, and his argument was, this guy had QTC prolongation. I wanted to make sure that he wasn't going to have a heart attack from the medications that I was giving him. And in a span of a year, he did 10 EKGs on him. And they said this was fraudulent, excessive use of EKGs, $6 yeah. each. And that was his healthcare fraud. So the investigative team from Mr. Chapman was able to actually bring in a local pharmacist who was a patient of Dr. Kusa, who testified on his behalf. And he says, I'm the local pharmacist. I dispense his prescriptions. He does not prescribe willy-nilly in terms of controlled substances. I support him 100%. He's my doctor. He does everything by the right way. And they were able to bring other colleagues from the emergency room who testified on his behalf.
Yeah.
So the defense attorney needs to be very creative and needs to mount a very strong and very progressive defense, bringing in witnesses that are patients, bringing in other colleagues, other positive witnesses, as well as expert witnesses, other physicians. And they did that very brilliantly in the Dr. Bothra case, which resulted in his acquittal of all charges. But the jury will see that. The juries are very, very intelligent. You don't have juries that could be hoodwinked. Some juries could be hoodwinked depending on the area and depending on what the prosecutors would do if they don't have a very expert criminal defense attorney with expertise in healthcare fraud. Some juries may be bamboozled, but the majority of juries are very, very intelligent, and they're able to figure out that this person is not guilty.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Dr. Rafai, thank you so much for sharing the wisdom and sharing your experiences. And I'm sure this will be the first of many conversations on this topic.
I'm very excited, and I look forward to being able to help our colleagues, physicians. I think we're going to be working with our colleague physicians on how is it that you could advocate for yourself. Some of the things that you could do, maybe talk a little bit about pro se. Self-representation in some cases. I know one of our colleagues did some pro se representation, but that could be very, very helpful for physicians and to advocate in specific things that are pertinent to physicians and to our future, and being able to send in briefs to appeals courts, to the Supreme Courts, even to circuit courts, as friend of the court, or an amicus brief to the appeals courts, to the circuit courts of appeals, being able to advocate specific physician cases, and I think in the next few years there's going to be a lot of physician cases. There have been some very positive things for physicians. Chevron deference, which is agency expertise, was overruled. So we're going to see a lot of things where actually the government has a higher burden of proof. They have to bring in experts, and that would be an opportunity for physicians to be able to prove that what they did was correct, as long as they followed all the rules and regulations. And we'd be able to prove their innocence if they're facing any legal issues or the government decided to indict them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rafai. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.